WHYY News.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. After less than a month on the job, National Security Advisor Michael Flynn resigned last night after being dogged by questions about his honesty regarding conversations he had with the Russian ambassador to the United States. He originally denied that he talked about sanctions. This was back in December, something the vice president repeated in a series of TV interviews. Flynn apologized and admitted to, quote, inadvertently briefing the vice president-elect and others with incomplete information. Well, it turns out the Justice Department was aware of the phone calls and worried that Flynn could be blackmailed by the Russian government. There are ongoing investigations regarding Russia's possible interference in the presidential election. There are also concerns about President Trump's business dealings, his relationship with the Trump Organization, his hotel in Washington, D.C., and his angry tweets at Nordstrom's that dropped his daughter's clothing line. All of this our topic for today's Radio Times, and joining us is Larry Noble. He's general counsel for the Campaign Legal Center. And Larry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
To be with you, Marty.
And we are hoping to hook up with Tom Hamburger from the Washington Post in just a moment or two. I have a bunch of questions for Tom Hamburger, who's working on this very particular story. But to you, Larry, of course, many questions. What's your main takeaway from Flynn's resignation and all the lead up, I guess, to that resignation and, of course, all the many questions that still remain?
We don't know what's going on. That's my main takeaway. This has been, obviously, the White House has known about this for a while. There's a report that the White House counsel, Don McGahn, was informed about this, that they knew about these calls. And there was silence from the White House and no real effort, no real evidence that they were doing anything about it until this really became public. And so I think this is not the end of it. Hopefully there will be some investigation into what went on. And it's interesting because they're focusing on the fact that he lied to Vice President Pence.
Right.
But there's another issue here, which is what did he talk about and was that appropriate? And also there's a broader issue of how much can we trust people in the White House on these issues. And for me, they really all do come back in some way to ethics issues about how the White House is looking at its obligation to the public and how various members of the White House staff are looking at their obligations to the public. So, you know, I hope this doesn't just end because there's some very serious issues and it goes beyond whether or not Flynn just lied to the vice president.
Well, is there also a question about what did President Trump know and when did he know it?
I think that's always a question. You know, what they talk about is what Flynn told Pence, but they're not talking, as far as I know, about what Flynn may have told Trump and or what Trump discussed with Flynn about these types of things. And, you know, this whole Russian connection is very disturbing to people. And, you know, it's not something I think they can easily brush away. So this is not just an isolated incident. You know, there's a lot of talk. There's a lot of evidence about various relationships with Russia. And some of this was known before that, you know, that Flynn was close to Russia. And so I think we really have to have this all laid out on the table because it is a national security issue. It is, you know, it's you know, one of Congress's jobs is to investigate national security issues, ethics issues, problems in the White House. And I really think it's going to fall on the House and the Senate now to investigate. And I don't think they can just, you know, sweep this under the rug as a personnel issue of some sort.
And I want to pick up on all of that, but let me get Tom Hamburger in on the conversation. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, where he covers the intersection of money and politics, writing about Flynn's resignation. And Tom, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Was Michael Flynn pushed or did he decide on his own? Do we know the answer to that?
Well, we don't know the answer for certain, but there are plenty of indications that he was really forced to resign as questions that so far have not been answered continued to build and rise over the weekend. He was engaged and was working through yesterday, including not only during the meetings that President Trump had with Abe of Japan, but also with the Prime Minister of Canada. So he was very active, and then as things began to snowball last night, suddenly we received word that that he had submitted his resignation.
Larry Noble raised this, and I think we've all raised this, which is, do we know what Michael Flynn talked to the Russian ambassador to the U.S. about? Now, apparently there are transcripts, but does anyone know the actual content of that conversation?
So we don't, we have not seen the transcripts, but my colleagues at the Post and I have talked with people who are familiar with what's in them. And the thing that was abundantly clear and that we know so far is that he did discuss U.S. sanctions against Moscow with the Russian ambassador, contrary to what he told Vice President Pence. And so the immediate reason for the resignation, it seems, is that he was, in effect, caught telling the vice president one thing, but then faced evidence that he had done something else, that is, talked about sanctions with the Russian ambassador on the other hand. There are lots of questions about what exactly was discussed. We don't have a copy of the transcript, so we don't know precisely what was discussed, but it's been made abundantly clear by interviews with nine individuals who are familiar with them and in the senior folks in the national security realm, who made clear that Mr. Flynn did discuss sanctions with the Russian ambassador, contrary to what he had told the vice president and others.
What you're saying, Tom, is it was discussed, but we don't know whether it was, will get rid of the sanctions once President Trump is in office. We don't know any of the details beyond the fact that it came up.
We know that it came up, and we do know that the timing of the discussions occurred just before Vladimir Putin made this decision, which caught folks in the U.S. by surprise, that he would not do the sort of tit for tat sanctions. That is, the U.S. Sent 35 members of the Russian delegation to the U.S. home to Moscow. The expectation was that the same thing would occur in Russia. Instead, Vladimir Putin announces, no, we are not going to do the parallel ejection of U.S. personnel. It was a suggestion of goodwill, and one of the assumptions is that the discussion between Flynn and the ambassador had to do with preventing a sort of tit-for-tat response by the Russians in hopes that U.S. Relations with Moscow would improve after Inauguration Day.
Well, let me put something else on the table. We've learned, apparently, that the Justice Department was investigating all of this, and that the acting Attorney General Sally Yates, and I believe others as well, were concerned that Michael Flynn could be blackmailed. I want to go to you, Tom, but Larry, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on that as well. And we should add that Sally Yates was fired because she criticized President Trump's refugee ban. And I guess the question to you is, where does this leave your thinking as we try to figure out all the details of what has happened in the last couple of weeks, really?
Yeah, I think, you know, the last couple of weeks have been disturbing in a lot of different ways. Now, with Sally Yates, I mean, you know, the White House said that she was fired because she refused to defend the ban. She said she wasn't going to defend it in court. But we now learn there were other things going on. Now, I have no idea whether any of this had anything to do with her being fired. And she was going to be replaced eventually anyway. But, you know, what is of concern here is that obviously, Justice Department was looking at it. They did talk to the White House about this. From what I read, I believe today, that FBI Director Comey at first thought that they should not discuss it with the White House, and then said, I guess they should. And so, you know, what was the White House's reaction to this? It is a concern because, you have to make sure the internal watchdogs, are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, I have no reason to believe the Department of Justice wasn't doing what it thought was best. But again, in its interaction with the White House then has to take that and run with it and do what it thinks it was best. And so we just now have no idea what they were doing at this point, what the White House was doing. They were giving conflicting signs publicly about how much they backed Flynn. And you really wonder whether or not if they thought they could get away with it, they would have just kind of barreled their way through it and not done anything about Flynn.
Tom, do we know who in the White House, Sally Yates, or I guess others from the Justice Department, contacted or even talked to?
So our understanding is so far, and these questions are important because it takes us beyond the sort of immediate issue. Flynn resigned. It appears that he resigned. The immediate reason is that he told different a story that appears not to be untrue to the vice president. But the bigger question that this gets to is who else in the White House knew about Flynn's contacts with the Russians, discussing sanctions and other matters. So one of the things that we know is that Sally Yates, then the acting attorney general, delivered a message to the White House counsel. And the specific message was prompted by concerns that Flynn had told Mike Pence and others that he had not discussed sanctions when, in fact, he had. And one of the concerns in notifying the White House was not only that Michael Flynn had lied, but that the lie, in fact, could compromise him, could lead to some vulnerability or even blackmail by the Russians, who knew, as did the U.S. folks privy to these transcripts, that in fact what he had said was inaccurate.
So do we know what the White House counsel did with that information?
We don't know, and that's curious. And one of the questions is, did they tell the president immediately or not about this warning? It would seem from other folks that we have talked to and other veterans of national security councils from administrations past, Republican and Democrat, that if such a warning came in from the Justice Department about a person in a critical position, and the national security advisor, of course, as we all know, is one of the most important positions in the U.S. hierarchy of governance, it would be impossible to imagine that the president himself would not have been informed. That's what we hear from veterans of other White Houses, Republicans and Democrats, but we don't yet have the answer to the question which you're asking. Who else knew in the White House? Was the president informed, and when was he informed?
Tom, I know you have to leave us in about 45 seconds. Is this the responsibility of Congress then to investigate this, or is this something that the White House would investigate for itself?
Well, we already have sort of urgent requests for investigation from the Congress. Congress has oversight responsibility here. And I'd remind you that there are already two investigations of some significance, three actually, two in the Senate and one in the House, looking at the role that the Russian government played in the U.S. election in 2016. And it is quite possible that this will figure into that discussion, since General Flynn had traveled to Russia in 2015 and was mentioned as one of those in the Trump world who had ties to the Kremlin.
Much more to talk about. Tom Hamburger, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times. Reporter for The Washington Post, he covers the intersection of money and politics. Larry Noble staying with us for the rest of the hour. General counsel for the Campaign Legal Center talking about a whole host of things, including the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking about what I think probably the whole country is talking about, the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and the various questions raised about his relationship to Russia, his lack of truthfulness with the Trump administration, and specifically with Vice President Pence. Larry Noble, general counsel for the Campaign Legal Center, is with us. Also with us is Robert Costa, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. And Robert Costa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to join you.
So is Washington abuzz with this story?
I think it's electrified by this story. This is a story just a month into a presidency that captures the chaos within an administration and all these swirling questions about Russia and foreign influence and Donald Trump's judgment and leadership. It cuts to the core of what his presidency is all about.
Well, I'm also thinking this was yesterday, Kellyanne Conway saying that Michael Flynn enjoyed the trust of President Trump. Then we heard Sean Spicer rather quickly after that saying there were some sort of questions or concerns about the future of Michael Flynn. Robert Casa, what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that Kellyanne Conway remains a confidant of the president, but she has not been involved in all of the discussions around General Flynn and his role. What's important to understand, based on my reporting from inside of the White House, is that this process was driven in part by the media, by solid reporting about Flynn and his role by places like the Washington Post, and it was also driven by Vice President Pence and his allies. They felt very uncomfortable in their view that Flynn was not entirely straight with them, misled them in some ways about his conversations with the Russian ambassador, and that discomfort within Pence's camp. And you have to remember, Pence is a very agreeable person. He is well-liked within the White House. When he gets angry, it's a rare moment, and that's when things started to turn.
Who are his allies within the White House, Robert?
Well, he's part of the mainstream Republican wing within the White House, and he has one of the deputy legislative directors of the White House, Mark Short, his longtime advisor working there, Ryan Priebus, the chief of staff, is close with Vice President Pence, and others such as Steve Bannon have built a relationship with him. And so Flynn's found himself with few public allies, diminished status inside with few private allies inside of the White House, this torrent of journalism against him, and he was a lonely figure in the last few days.
Larry, let me go back to you and talk a bit more. This is not news, but Michael Flynn's relationship with Russia. We know that he spoke at an event hosted by Russian television, RT. He sat at a table where Vladimir Putin was. He was also a paid speaker. Does that raise questions about this emoluments clause that we're all learning about?
It does, because actually the emoluments clause applies to military and former military officials, because they can always be called back. And so, yes, there is a question there about whether the payment violated the emoluments clause, because RT is, my understanding, is owned by the Russian government. So this problem existed even before the latest issue came up, and it just underscores the problems with, one, the whole approach to the ethics issues and that the administration has taken. Two, that the people that they have put in high positions have these connections, including connections with foreign governments. And three, they've not been very forthcoming about it. One of the things in hearing Robert talk that occurs to me is that, again, we're focused on lying to Pence. If Pence had been told about this, and therefore found a way to get around the question of whether what Flynn said to the Russians when he talked to them,
right.
This wouldn't have been a bit news story, but we still have the same problem. That prior to, while they were still in transition, Flynn was talking to the Russians about sanctions. And we have to keep in mind that the genesis of the sanctions talk was because of the concern of the Russians hacking our election or interfering with our election. So, there is kind of a whole pattern here of dealings where we tend to get, I think this is what's happening with this administration, we get one after another in terms of specifics that come out, and we react to that, and we at some point have to step back and look at the pattern that has formed here. But on the emoluments clause issue, yes, the Flynn did raise an emoluments clause issue, and just to explain for anybody who doesn't know, that's a constitutional clause that says that a president cannot take any present or gift or anything really from a foreign government. And it was a provision that was put in the Constitution to prevent government officials from feeling beholden in any way to foreign governments, and for very good reason. So, there is this whole pattern. We see individual little things. We tend to, just the way they've been coming out day to day, focus on each individual one, but I think there's a much larger story here.
Well, I do want to get to that, but Bill Clinton has given speeches all over the world. I mean, is this a different? I'm thinking about Michael Flynn speaking in Russia, but we know that other leaders have spoken and I'm assuming gotten paid by governments or people affiliated with governments for their speeches. Am I missing something, Larry?
Yeah, Bill Clinton did that after he left office. So, you know, whether or not you think it's appropriate for a former president to make a lot of money giving speeches, it's not illegal. Flynn, as a military officer, was a subject to recall, and therefore he is covered by different laws.
I got you. Robert, going back to you, there is a question apparently raised by the Justice Department, former Attorney General, that there could be the potential for blackmail. Do you understand, I guess, the thinking behind this potential threat?
It's complicated, and the Post reported this last night that the Justice Department and Sally Yates at the time, a now departed acting Attorney General, was part of the group at the Justice Department telling the White House and the administration that because these calls with Flynn had been recorded with the Russian ambassador, that he was vulnerable, whether it was about misspeaking to people inside of the administration about the content of those conversations, or was about some other statement he made while he thought he was having a confidential call with the ambassador. Flynn was seen as vulnerable. The White House was warned. The interesting perspective that I've picked up from the Trump side in my reporting is that they're furious. They, one, don't understand why Flynn was recorded. Of course, many things are recorded in Washington on the intelligence and ambassador side of things. But they're not happy about Flynn being recorded without really knowing he was recorded. But, of course, you shouldn't maybe have the expectation that these conversations are always private. And they also think the former Obama – this is not with evidence, really, but they keep telling reporters that they think the former Obama intelligence officials are really leaking this kind of information to the press. And so there's this culture of suspicion now in the White House about leaks, about – you see Trump even – the president tweeting this morning about leaks in Washington. Right. It almost brings back the Nixon era in a sense when leaks dominated the conversations, because right now there are a lot of leaks happening in D.C. and it's got this new administration on edge.
Well, do you think there's some truth, Robert, that there's sort of bad, if not bad blood, bad feeling between those left over from the Obama administration and this new administration?
I mean, there may well be. As a reporter, I think the more information, the better. I mean, it's a great time for reporters if we can get more information about what these people in power are actually saying. It's very revealing to know. Think about this. We didn't know a few months ago that General Flynn was having these calls with the ambassador. We didn't know that he was probably talking about sanctions. Some in the White House didn't know that Flynn was maybe mentioning sanctions in these conversations even before the president was inaugurated. This is all very valuable information for the public. So whether it's driven by bad blood or not, that's for the others to decide.
Yes, I think we should all know pretty much what's going on. Larry, let me go back to you. And you mentioned the fact that this is sort of a piece of a potential pattern. The FBI, as I understand it, is investigating Paul Manafort, a former campaign chair when Trump was running for president, about his ties to Russia. What else is being looked at in terms of Russia's either involvement in the election and or the relationship between members of the Trump campaign and Russian officials?
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, there's Paul Manafort, and then there's obviously the big one, which is the Russian hacking of our, right, what we're calling the Russian hacking of our election, which would be Russian interference with our election. And then there is also this question, you know, which the press has been handling, you know, somewhat delicately about this dossier that was done, originally apparently started as opposition research about Trump and information that it contains. And some of it is, you know, obviously, you know, salacious information about what Trump allegedly did while in Russia. But you know, recent reports have been that you know, some of these early vetting of that information, that some of the sources seem to check out, not necessarily about the specific activity regarding Trump, but about other things mentioned in this dossier that was done by a former intelligence, I think it was a British intelligence official. And so, you know, there's also that. And, you know, apparently they're looking into that. So, and there are other things I suspect that they may be looking into that we're not fully aware of. You know, the question of leaks are interesting because, you know, even the Obama administration had trouble with leaks. And President Obama did a lot to try to crack down on leaks.
Yes, he did.
And I agree with Robert that, you know, it is every administration has to live with it. You know, it is a part of our democracy. It's a part of the way things work. But the leaks aren't only from what I understand, and Robert probably knows more about this than I do. The leaks aren't only from former Obama people in the White House. Now I think the White House is concerned about leaks from people who are Trump people in the White House. And you sometimes see this where they think things are starting to fall apart or they think things are problematic. And also there's infighting about who's going to who's going to have the power in the White House that people around him may be leaking also. And it does harken back to Nixon, and it tends to make presidents a little bit paranoid, you know, sometimes with good reason, about what's happening. But those leaks are important, and you have to be able to sift through what is factual, what there's some basis for, what's just infighting. And unfortunately here, there is a fair amount that looks like, if true, are serious matters.
Robert, is this any more a chaotic transition of a presidency from one to the other compared to from Bush to Obama, from Clinton to Bush? Is this unusual?
It is unusual, but it's not the first time we've ever seen an outsider candidate really struggle. What makes Trump so different is that he does not have any governing experience. Bill Clinton came in with all these years of being governor. I think a little bit more back to Jimmy Carter, a one-term governor from Georgia, had some difficulty at first setting up the White House, realizing what he wanted to do. But Trump confronts this social media 24/7 Edward Snowden era that we all live in, and his lack of government experience. It leads to learning experiences on the job. We saw that over the weekend when he was at his winter White House, Mar-a-Lago, in Palm Beach, and he's sitting there with Prime Minister Abe of Japan as they go over classified information and intelligence in the ballroom of a golf club, or not a golf club, but a private club in Palm Beach. And with Flynn, he's reacting to the news in many ways. There's all this tumult. And so we're really seeing in real time a president learn the ropes.
Well, and just a quick follow-up on that, Larry, we're learning that this all happened kind of in the middle of a very public place where the administration was dealing with some of these serious national security issues.
Right. And yeah, I think what is different about this one is, yes, there's a learning curve. I'm not sure he's learning. It seems to be that his focus, President Trump seems to be really convinced that he can do things differently and he doesn't have to really follow the old rules. And the whole Mar-a-Lago incident over the weekend was really bizarre. The fact that, they refer to it as the Winter White House, and you hear sometimes the administration say, well, President Bush had the ranch in Texas, and President Obama went to Hawaii, but these weren't public resorts. These weren't public clubs, or they're not private clubs, but they're open to the public if you have $200,000. And they weren't conducting their business in public that way. And the fact that I almost had the sense, and this is just a personal statement, that it was almost like he was showing off for those around him, that he wasn't concerned. His first concern wasn't to get away and go to someplace confidential, someplace where he'd have privacy, but rather he was showing that he was president. And apparently he went from from the dinner where they were told about North Korea, and he then went to a wedding that was there and said a few words at the wedding about how these people were members of the club. And it's as if he doesn't get the idea that he's not running a business. He's not running his business. He's running the government right now. And so I agree that we've had other outsider presidents who've had learning curves, but you get the sense on those that at least they wanted to learn, and that they got the sense of the responsibility they now have. I'm not sure President Trump yet gets it fully, the responsibility he has, and that this is not running a business. This is running the government.
And that is Larry Noble along with Robert Costa. Let me read a couple of comments. A tweet from Joe: feels like there'll be no consequences. Who's going to prosecute when the GOP runs the White House and Congress? Comment from David: I'm not surprised. Scandal after scandal permeated the Trump campaign. Tweet from TM: not sure House oversight will do anything. Robert, there's a fair amount of pessimism I'm seeing from comments coming in. Where does this leave the Republican-controlled Congress, the House, and the Senate?
It's a great question. Republicans do control the House and the Senate. and there's not really a drive yet to have this kind of investigative culture around a new Republican president. Is that politics? Of course it's politics. We saw this with pressure on Jason Chaffetz, the Utah congressman who's chairman of the Oversight Committee. He got a real angry response at a recent town hall in Utah, of all places, a mostly Republican state, saying, do your job, have oversight of the Trump administration. But Democrats do see some positive things in the tea leaves. They think, look, we don't have power in Washington now, they tell me, but in 2018, this could be a real way to drive people to the polls, that no one's investigating Trump. The Democrats have to have some power to make sure he's investigated.
To you, Larry, we're almost up on a break here, but I'm just thinking back. I don't want to get ahead of myself. I'm thinking about the Watergate. I mean, it took a while for Congress to have some kind of investigation. I'm not saying we are there yet, but it seems like at least if past is any guide for the present or the future, these things take time.
They do take some time. And yes, we're not there yet. But one of the striking things about Watergate was that it eventually became bipartisan. We're dealing then with the Republican president and the Republicans, many of them got on board, and the only reason it worked was that it became bipartisan, and eventually the Republicans went to the president and said, it's over. We're still early in this process, but so far there doesn't seem to be any interest on the side of the Republicans to really look into this. And I think Chaffetz recently said that, he didn't see doing a major oversight hearing on these issues. And I think, frankly, that's something the public is really going to have to deal with. And whether it's, sending letters, calling, doing whatever they do. But this is a part of the oversight responsibility of Congress. And these are serious issues in terms of national security, in terms of ethics. And it is hard to imagine. Obviously, all these things are political, but it's hard to imagine if this was a Democratic president that a Republican Congress would not be in the middle of investigations already about this. But their basic responsibility is oversight, and they're going to have to do something about it eventually.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I want to put some other things on the table for discussion, talking with Larry Noble and Robert Costa, and with you. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Robert Costa, national politics reporter for The Washington Post, and Larry Noble, general counsel for the Campaign Legal Center. We've been spending most of the hour talking about the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. I do want to talk also about President Trump's business dealings, his relationship with the Trump Organization, his hotel in Washington, D.C., and his angry tweets at Nordstrom that dropped his daughter's clothing line. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Douglas. He says, Michael Flynn is a military man and presumably someone who would typically work within a chain of command. Someone probably directed General Flynn to contact the Russian ambassador. That's Douglas's point of view. Let me get Dave from Maple Glen to join our conversation. Dave, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Great show.
Thank you.
I just am really enjoying this delicious situation where Flynn, who was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency and one of the guys who was a real promoter of, spying on everybody and, the whole NSA kind of spying, is now caught up by their own spying. Maybe it will wake people up in government to the pervasiveness of this spying. You can't get on the phone, even if you're a top security government person or a general, you can be spied on and ratted out.
Well, Dave, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And that goes to you, Robert Costa. Wouldn't Flynn know that his phone call or phone calls would have been monitored? I don't know. I'm just floating that out there for you. Do we have Robert Costa?
The caller said he has this history and this career steeped in the intelligence world, and so he probably knows his calls were likely had at least the vulnerability of being recorded. But most of these White House officials and intelligence officials I encounter, they have very secure lines, cell phones. but I guess in Washington, nothing's ever as secure as you think, because not only did these calls happen when Flynn likely thought they were confidential, but there are full transcripts that are floating out there of these calls with the Russian ambassador. So Flynn was, in a sense, boxed in. I mean, he told some people one thing about what he had done, and then there are intelligence officials out there, I think from maybe more than just the U.S., from Russia and elsewhere, who have transcripts. And so they're listening in.
Let me put something else on the table to you, Larry Noble. President Trump has said he will not release his tax returns. He said that as a candidate, continues to say that as president. One of his descriptions is that it's under audit. Is there anything that anyone can do to force the president to release his tax returns? And is that important?
It is important, not directly. There may be situations where in lawsuits where the tax returns may have to be released. But actually, he originally said in one campaigning that he would release his tax returns.
Right. He did.
And now has said he won't. And the excuse that he's being audited, it's true. It's his right not to release his tax returns. The IRS can't release them. But there's nothing that prevents him from releasing them, even though he's being audited. And I believe Nixon released tax returns while he was being audited. And now President Trump says, well, nobody cares, but a lot of people do care. And I think they are important. And a lot of it goes to these ethics issues, goes to the dealings with Russia, because we would learn a lot more, presumably, about his financial situation and about investments he has, about connections he has and if any of them with foreign governments or foreign corporations that are involved with foreign governments. So it is very important that they're released. And one of the things we haven't talked about yet is, we need to have congressional oversight and investigations, and I think that's a critical part. In the meantime, lawsuits have been filed and are going to be filed against this administration. And as part of those lawsuits, we may find more information coming out. And we're only 4 weeks into this administration. We've already got at least one major lawsuit filed, and I think we will see others. And I also think, as I said before, that as time goes on, unless there is a very steep a change in direction, and there is a quick learning curve here, I think we're going to see a lot more call for investigations and a lot more lawsuits.
Robert, let me go to you. And this is pretty wonky here, but I'm looking at an article about New Jersey Democrat Bill Pascrell, representative. He serves on the House Ways and Means Committee. He says there's a 1924 law that gives Congress committees that set tax policy the power to examine tax returns. Apparently was used against or with President Richard Nixon, and it looks like he's going to use this as a way to call for tax returns. Can you add anything to that?
Hey, Pascrell certainly has been talking about Trump's tax returns for a long time, and there may be a legislative effort afoot to make this happen. But knowing, as a congressional reporter, with Speaker being Paul Ryan, the Republican having the majority, it's going to be difficult to see how this could actually happen with the Democrats having the minority. But he's at least raising the issue.
Let me go back to you. This we've talked about several times, Larry, but I'm just curious about where you think things stand when it comes to the Trump Organization being run by President Trump's two older sons. Is there enough, transparency and enough of a wall between the president and his organization that bears his name?
No. Many people in my organization did this, also called for him to divest his interests, his financial interests, and to really separate himself financially and practically from his businesses, and they refused to do that. Instead, I think it was on January 11th, he held a press conference and showed all these papers that he was going to give over management of the companies to his children and, I guess, put his financial interests in a trust, not a blind trust, but a trust, so presumably he would get the interest back when he left the presidency. And that was weak. That was not sufficient. But what we've seen since then is that it was basically meaningless, because with the tweet of Nordstrom's He still is obviously concerned about his kids' businesses. The fact that his kids still continue to come to official events. So from the, that may seem innocuous, but from somebody in a foreign country or a business person looking to do business with his children, it just reinforces that they're connected. Obviously, have a close connection to his father. And the way he's dealing with Mar-a-Lago right now, he acted more like a proprietor of a resort than he did as president when he was there, going to a wedding there. So he's not, I don't think he's capable, frankly, of separating himself from the businesses the way he said he was. And if he was going to do as little as he was going to do legally, you would at least expect him to make an effort to actually, in terms of appearances, stay away from his businesses. But it doesn't look like he's doing that. We were also told, by the way, that they would not do any new deal foreign deals. And right now, it looks like what they're doing is they're continuing foreign deals that were already started. They're going to pursue foreign deals that were already started. So they're slicing these things very thin. There is no wall between himself and the businesses. We haven't talked about this yet, but he has a hotel in Washington where it now turns out that at least in one case, a foreign government has paid for somebody to stay there. And so there are all these connections that I think are only going to get worse as time goes on. And I think they leave him vulnerable in a way that people overseas or businesses overseas or countries overseas are going to use these connections in various ways to, one, make themselves look stronger, but also in certain ways, I think, as leverage or potentially as leverage against the White House. And I think that's something that we have to be really concerned about.
Robert Costa, I'm curious about this hotel, very grand hotel in Washington, D.C., that opened last fall. Now, the building, as I understand it, is owned by the General Services Administration, the GSA. Does that make Trump both the landlord and the renter?
In some ways, yes. It's a beautiful building for years before Trump bought the rights to the property. My family used to go up on the tower there. It's a tower that has a phenomenal view of the city. It's an interesting arrangement because the government, in many ways, because it's a historic site and it's the old post office, the government still controls the tower. And Trump, of course, controls his own hotel. It's a strange situation. Just right down the street from the White House is another major Trump building, and it raises questions about how much can he really be divested from his businesses. He says his sons, Eric and Don, are running things, but the way the Trump Organization ran for years, and I cover this throughout the campaign, is that everything came through Donald Trump, that it was a circle around the boss. It wasn't a layered leadership. There wasn't a lot of hierarchy. Trump controlled everything. He had decisions on the colors of couches in the lobby to the way something was decorated to a menu on a restaurant. And his fingerprints were everywhere. And it's been, I think, difficult for the Trump Organization in some respects to move away from that culture. And now Trump has a lot of, not just the post office, but he has dealings with the federal government at a variety of his properties, not as direct, but he is someone who is in a way in an unprecedented situation in terms of having all these business interests around the country and around the world, and he doesn't have his tax returns, and it's very murky about everything.
Larry, let me...
Marty,
go ahead.
Interesting part, just to follow up on what about the hotel, is that, so it is the property is run by GSA.
Right.
The head of GSA is appointed by the president. The president just replaced the head of GSA. There's also an issue here of law that stops a federal employee stops GSA from basically having a lease with a federal employee. Now, they argue that means when they entered the lease, the Trump people argue that it means that he couldn't have been a federal employee when he entered the lease, and he wasn't. But others argue that, no, it means that GSA should not have a lease with a federal employee. And it's just really it's really exacerbated here because when there a question comes up about compliance with the lease, who has responsibility for making those decisions? And that's GSA, the head of GSA. Who's the boss of GSA? Donald Trump. So yes, he has leased with himself right now, and he is the one who will decide if his company is in violation of that lease. And it's a very bizarre and unacceptable situation.
I wonder if it's time, though, Larry, to update the conflict of interest laws. I'm thinking of previous presidents who largely owned stocks and bonds. They put it in a blind trust, and everyone seemed to be satisfied by that. But Trump's wealth comes from real estate. It comes from naming rights of buildings around the world. It's a little different, it seems to me, to put something like that into a blind trust.
Yes, and you know, on that part, you know, where people say, "What did you expect him to do?" You know, my short answer to that is he didn't have to run for president if this was going to be a problem. Everybody who joins the government, no matter what level, understands there are certain sacrifices you make. And as president, you're going to make tremendous sacrifices to join the government. And it's the reason many people don't join the government. Many wealthy people decide not to join the government because of what they'd have to give up. He has said that, you know, the president is not president can't have conflicts of interest. That's not true. Conflicts of interest can exist with the president. They do with this one. The main conflict of interest law, Section 208, doesn't apply to the president. And that was done for a variety of reasons, including concerns about separation of powers. But it may be time. You know, Trump may force Congress, maybe a future Congress, to look at those laws and decide, you know, to put in stricter requirements. And he could be made to, or president in the future could be made to divest themselves from certain financial interests and just make it clear, instead of relying on what has become a practice and the good sense of previous presidents to get rid of conflicts of interest, put general investments in a blind trust so that they don't have these problems. And if somebody's going to test the system the way he's testing the system, it may be time to look at the system again and decide that it's not adequate the way we're doing it.
Let me get Michael from Collegeville to join our conversation. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. You may have already covered this. I was a little late to getting into the car to listen to the radio on the way to work. But my question is, with particular respect to the end of the Jimmy Carter era and the beginning of the Reagan era, whereby there's, I think, more than a plethora of evidence that indicates this sort of like either backdoor or not so much secretive, but like prior to election, trying to get ducks in a row so that once you are elected, you can kind of knock them down and take all the credit for them. And I guess my question is, if there's any sort of either legal, ethical, or kind of like politically moral recourse to approach that and say, well, we know what you're doing, and here's why we're not going to let you do that.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I think he's referring to the October surprise, and there was there's certainly some questions. Robert, I don't even know if you were born then. I don't know if you can answer that or not.
Well, I was born in 85.
Okay.
So I'll try to do my best here. So I think that there are a lot of possibilities about more surprises down the way. Marty, you think the caller is really talking about the Carter era in specifics or in general with presidents?
Perhaps general with presidents.
I just think that we're just trying to learn so much that there's because of the tax returns, the lack of tax returns are actually indicative of the larger question here, is that there's an intelligence community in Washington, a press in Washington, a Congress that are all seeing this administration, this White House as a black box and still trying to figure it out. And because no one really understands how the Trump operation works, there's a lot of leaks going on, a lot of conversations, even among Republicans to reporters about what's actually happening here. And so the possibility for more curveballs, more surprises, I think is very much on the horizon.
Larry, we're almost out of time. I'm giving you the final word. Go ahead.
Yeah, on the question that was just asked, I mean, that was the deal with the release of the hostages in Iran. The concern was, and there's always been an understanding that incoming administrations are going to have to be involved or have some involvement in you know, in getting ready. There is a law, the Logan Act, that that prevents a private citizen from interfering with international relations of the United States or international policy of the United States. It's never been enforced, and I don't think it will be. But I think it raises questions about this administration going further than any other administration has gone. And the one thing we need now is clarity, and we need transparency. We need investigations. We need to understand what's going on here. It's only the fourth week. The way we're going, we're going to see a lot more problems.
Larry Noble, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Pleasure.
And he's general counsel for the Campaign Legal Center. Robert Costa, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National politics reporter for The Washington Post. We began with Tom Hamburger, also a reporter for The Washington Post, covering the intersection of money and politics. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.